Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secured retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in, because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Hello, everyone. David Phelps here from the Freedom Founders Mastermind Committee, here with my good friend, Mr. Mike Zlotnick from the TF Management Company. We're here today that we want to talk to you about real estate funds. We're going to give you the overview, the big picture of investing in real estate, and then we'll show you where we're going today with funds. I'm going to tell you right now that Mike Zlotnick has been a really dear friend of mine. We've been in different mastermind groups together now for probably a half a dozen years. And he put this presentation together because he is the expert here. I'm here just to add some commentary and some sideline comedy, perhaps. But Mike is actually the guy who knows this very, very well. So, Mike, I'm going to basically turn this over to you. And really, I'll just maybe ask for some definitions or clarity from time to time. But I'm going to let you run with this. You've done a great job putting this together. So I'll let you take it from there.
Thank you very much, David. I appreciate it. Our friendship and your leadership in the space in the financial freedom is remarkable. I'm impressed every day how much leadership you provide, and it inspires me to move forward as well. So thank you kindly. This is a disclaimer. This is for educational purposes only. We'll talk about our flagship fund, Tampa Opportunity Fund. It's available to accredited investors only through private placement memorandum. Please request that and consult your professional before making any investment decisions. This is not solicitation to sell anything at all, just for educational purposes. And if you look at the data, please realize that the past results don't guarantee future performance. Who is David? David, would you be so kind to say a couple of words about you? You have a remarkable story. You have a wonderful daughter, and she's a survivor and an inspiration for a lot of people.
Okay, I'll make this very brief. Former practicing dentist, but got involved in real estate at a very young age, actually before I got out of dental school, graduated dental school, and built up a pretty sizable real estate portfolio on the side, left dentistry when my daughter that you see there, Jenna, at age 12, had a life-saving liver transplant, decided enough of it was enough of being a dentist, because while it provided really good active income, it didn't provide me any freedom. And I realized that the real estate that I had been just disciplined in investing in over a number of years, about 15 years at that point, actually had provided enough replacement income, replacement recurring passive income, that I actually could let go of the dental practice and spend time where I really wanted to spend the time. That was with my family, with my daughter. Fast forward, Jenna, that picture was taken maybe a couple years ago. She'll be 27 this year. So she has survived leukemia, epilepsy, and a liver transplant. And I just tell people today that if not for real estate, you know, having that plan B in place, I wouldn't be able to have the freedom I have today. While dentistry was a great place to be, Mike, and as everybody has a career path that they start into, having the opportunity, the choice, the option to change your life role when necessary, maybe because you have to because of a life situation like I had, or maybe because you want to because you want to turn a different corner, having an asset-based investment portfolio, which is what we're talking about today, one part of that, is my opinion, after doing this for almost 40 years, it is the way to go. So that's my brief story today. I facilitate today a mastermind called Freedom Founders, which is primarily professional practice owners who want to do the same thing, build alternative investment portfolio that provides them that sustainable growth along with the cash flow that is indexed to inflation. And Mike, you're one of our key supporters, one of our trusted advisors. You're part of our investment underwriting committee that reviews all types of syndications. Without the community, without people like you, we couldn't do what we do. So now back to you, Mike. I'm going to let you tell us about your background and your lovely family that keeps you on the go all the time.
Thank you, David. Well, the next slide is your offer of a book.
Okay. All right. Back to me. Okay. All right. A book I wrote just a few years ago based on the premise that, yes, as professionals in any career industry, you're able to make a pretty solid active income, which provides for lifestyle. So I wrote the book From High Income to High Net Worth. The point being, how do you take the high income you can make as a high earner and turn that into net worth or equity that produces the cash flow that you want to give you freedom at a certain time in your life and throughout your life? So that book's available. Go to freedomfounders.com/gift and we can send that book to you. And then for those who would like to check into and see what we do in the mastermind, you can go to freedomplanners.com/apply, and we'd be glad to talk to you about what we do and see if there's a fit. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, David. A couple of words about me. I also go as a Big Mike, Big Russian, and married, coming up on 20 years, four kids, and a cat. Here you can see a picture of the cat. It's the fifth child. So, I'm a fund manager and a real estate investor. I've been doing this for since 2000. This is really my passion, love doing it, and a little bit of specialty hard money, bridge lending, and we do value-add equity investments with focus on predictable cash flow, value-add driven appreciation in various types of assets, self-storage, multifamily, office, retail, and so on. I'm at your service. I do have a book out as well, and we're working on the new book, David, with you and Ryan. Hopefully, we'll have another book out shortly. But in the meanwhile, this is a good book if you are looking to decide which fund to select. Book is available on Amazon. If you reach out to me electronically, I can get you an e-copy for free. It is available in Kindle and hard copy. And I do have a podcast, bigmikefund.com. Appreciate you listening. I think it does provide some value, but you'd be a judge of that. So if you want to schedule some time with me, just go to bigmikecall.com and you can schedule time to chat. Let's talk a little bit about different types of investing. And this is a broad universe. We can talk a little bit about individual deals or funds. Individual deals could be single asset, like an investment house, single family residential. It could be a commercial building, or it could be syndication, where there is still one commercial asset and there are many investors. So let's just differentiate. The individual deal, one investor, one property, that's a single investment. When you have individual property and many investors, that is a syndication. When you have many assets, many properties, could be mix of commercial, residential, so on and so forth. But there are many investments. And then there are many investors putting their money together. That creates a fund. I hope that makes a difference. Did that explain the lay of the land, at least the basics?
Yeah, very good. And I think you make the point well on the slide that with individual assets, you do have a higher risk concentration, which can be good and bad. Sometimes you want to have more control. In that regard, you actually have more control with that one asset. You can still diversify if you have those single assets. But on the other side, with a fund, you've got certainly a widespread diversification based on what the fund manager is investing in through the operational agreement of that fund. And you've typically got lower volatility, as you mentioned, because you've got these different asset classes that in the mix that keep any one particular asset from either outperforming or maybe non-performing as well. So I think you've covered that well there. I think that gives a good lay of the land.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And continue through the slides. What's interesting, last weekend I had a conversation with a gentleman who was thinking to roll over their funds from, or transfer their funds from stock market 401k into self-directed IRA investing. And we start chatting, and the conversation went, well, what should I invest in first? And the most important question is how much money you are rolling over. If you're rolling over, let's just say $100,000, $200,000 or $300,000, it's not a small number, but it's not a huge number. It's difficult to diversify into many syndications, and the fund may be the first step. But if you're rolling over, say, $1 million or more, you could create diversification by breaking it up fairly quickly among, say, 10 investments. So the fund is a diversified vehicle. That's why it probably becomes a first consideration. Once you have the base sort of made out of a couple of funds, maybe at that point you can invest in individual deals because you already have some diversification. Anyway, here are a few differences. General individual deals have low liquidity, while funds have better liquidity. It depends on the type of fund, but most do. Liability risks generally are not there with a fund. With individual deals, liability risk could come from the fact that if you're signing on a mortgage and you're a single owner of the property, you're on the hook for the debt. With individual deals, you probably have more active involvement. If it's a syndication, you're still passive. Generally speaking, with the funds, you're always passive. Individual deals, you have idle funds because there's no ability to reinvest the funds. With funds, you typically can reinvest, and the fund's always working. And be absolutely careful if you're investing funds, IRA funds, into a syndication or individual deal, like you're buying a property and you're getting a mortgage. You may be subject to UBIT, UBTI, unrelated business income tax, related to the leverage. When you put the money in the fund and the fund has no leverage in the fund level, you should not be subject to UBIT, just for information. And again, funds are pretty flexible on the reinvestment, so distributions and dividends. You can add money, you could redeem shares and withdraw money. So now let's talk a little bit about public versus private funds. And there's a big difference. Majority folks know about public funds. They are traded on publicly traded exchanges, NASDAQ, NYSE, and others. And typically in real estate, these publicly traded securities are known as REITs, real estate investment trusts. Some REITs are very diversified and some are vertically focused. So examples would be the self-storage REIT or office space REIT, and some are broadly diversified REITs. In today's environment, most of these REITs are yielding low return. So whatever the market yield is, and the market is so high that the yields are generally pretty low in today's environment. And the appreciation is linked to the market performance in general. And there are a few different types of funds. There's growth and income, and then there's a growth and income mix. In the private universe, generally speaking, these funds are offered through a vehicle called Private Placement Memorandum, PPM. These funds are offered directly by the fund managers, typically. And those funds could be also diversified or vertically focused. Some are focused on cash flow, and some are focused on value add projects. Generally speaking, REITs, they hold assets, they don't invest in heavy value add projects. And then the private developers or private fund managers, they often invest with a value add strategy. So the opportunities in the private space are often significantly higher than in the public space, because a public space solving different types of problems. They're solving a problem of utilization of a lot of capital, and their job is to manage the portfolio and keep it steady. In the private investment space, there are a lot of opportunities where the value is created, and there's growth related to the value add strategy. And again, some of these projects could be speculative, growth, income, or growth and income. Any other thoughts and comments from your perspective?
No, I think you're covering that well. Well, when you talk about the publicly traded REITs, real estate investment trusts, a lot of people do talk about that's a way to invest in real estate. But as you said, it's the market yield and the appreciation is linked to the market. When you talk about the market here, Mike, you're talking about the financial market.
Correct. I'm talking about the securities that are traded on the exchanges. And their yield distribution is what they distribute, and their stock price is a function of the market speculation. It's a beauty and a curse. So the publicly traded securities are generally pretty liquid, while privates are not as liquid.
Right.
Publicly traded securities, the price could drop just as it could go up quickly. If the market sentiment changes and there's nervousness in the market, investors can act irrationally. So it's a beauty and a curse, depending on how you look at it. The private placement memorandums often provide stability, but they're not publicly traded securities. You can't just click a button, sell, and sell it. You can request a redemption, and the fund manager, if they're able to, they will grant you a redemption, and you'll get your cash.
That's a good comparison.
Thank you. Let me keep rolling forward. So here is an interesting look at the fund objective and investment philosophy. Just giving you a little bit of a lay of the land so folks can understand what these things are out there. So there are Wall Street terms: conservative investing, moderate, or aggressive. You hear these type of terms used in classification of various funds. And then the Main Street, I like to use the words investment grade and speculative grade, just simplifying things. And we've talked in the past about four quadrants, but I wanted to mention them again. And this is part of what you do in the Freedom Founders. You help folks understand the difference between investing for safety versus investing for speculation. And these four slides explain a little bit what happens. And I like to think of this, the number one reason why something is investment grade versus something is speculative. is a downside protection. This is so much more applicable in today's market when we're at the peak of the cycle and we're likely to get into some level of recession. Downside protection is the most valuable thing you could have in this environment. So quadrant one and quadrant two are investment grade, and quadrant three and four are speculative quadrants. And generally speaking, the risk level is lower with good downside protection. And then if you look at the quadrant one and three and quadrant two and four, the cash flow quadrants versus the growth quadrants. The big difference is cash flow focused investments may have some element of growth, but their primary focus is cash flow, and vice versa. The growth focused investments, they rely on the appreciation strategy versus focus on cash flow. And generally speaking, the risk level is a little bit lower in the cash because you're getting paid in cash than you're waiting for appreciation. However, there are plenty of speculative investments in the cash flow space. So here are some examples. For quadrant one, typically first lien loans, when performing notes, they generate good cash flow, and moderately leveraged equity projects, maybe syndication for multifamily, for self-storage, for office space, and so on. Quadrant two, so examples of this would be, generally speaking, first lien non-performing notes at a low LTV. The key word is low LTV, and light to moderate value add projects where the value add strategy increases value, but during the value add phase, the cash flow suffers somewhat. So those are examples of the quadrant two. The quadrant three, these are more aggressive deals. They're focused on cash flow. So second lien notes, a number of unsecured notes, corporate debt. Again, there's a corporate debt and there's corporate debt. At the moment, we're assuming not McDonald's corporate debt that is trading at a very low yield and considered to be safe. We're talking about private corporate debt. So secondly, notes, corporate debt, highly leveraged equity deals where the cash flow is strong while things are working. But when the economy turns and then it cracks in the ice, the cash flow could be heavily impacted to the high degree of leverage. That's quadrant three. Now let's look at quadrant four. Quadrant four is generally speaking a lot of speculative deal. So development, redevelopment, land speculation, all of those are quadrant four deals. Any other thoughts, comments on this one?
Only one thing, and you did a very good job here. I would say that when you're looking at quadrant one or quadrant two, investment grade versus quadrant three or four, which are speculative grade, then because the risk is going to be higher with quadrant three and four, then you would anticipate then in those buckets or those quadrants that your targeted, projected, and I know you're going to talk about returns a little bit later, would be higher. You're taking a higher risk. So the targeted return pro forma, if you will, should be higher on the investment grade side. You're taking less risk, so your yield return projection expectation would be lower, but you're in more of capital preservation mode there. So that kind of makes sense, but I want to make sure people understand that there is a place, perhaps in a portfolio, to take more speculation. But knowing what those quadrants are is the key, is knowing what you're getting involved in and how much of your allocated capital you want to put in various quadrants based on your goals.
David, this is great feedback. You touched on the key points, so people need to think about their portfolio locations, how much risk they're willing to take. And the most important thing is to look through this quadrant's lens before making any decision, and absolutely realize that the higher risk project, the speculative projects, they better have higher potential, otherwise why invest? Why take risk?
Right.
So here's a concept of risk-adjusted return, really important. This is exactly in line with your comments that the speculative projects have a certain degree of risk, and that risk mathematically translates to what is known as a loss reserve. And I like to think of it as a mathematical buffer. If you were to do statistically on average, and I know every project doesn't work like an average. Some of them work well, some don't work well, but you need to assign a number. So what I like to think and focus on, not just projected return, I like to focus on risk-adjusted return, which is equal to the projected return minus loss reserve associated with this type of investment. And please be aware that many funds and syndications state their projected returns, but they don't mention anything about risk-adjusted return. You should always lower expectations, in my opinion, by a level of speculation that give you projected minus the risk level associated reserves. That's what produces risk-adjusted return.
So, Mike, I know this is something that you do on a regular basis when through Tempo Fund or you're doing the IUC work for Freedom Founders and looking at different syndications, fund opportunities. You are always looking at the risk-adjusted return and projecting what, in with your experience, you know, loss reserves should be on an investment grade versus a speculative grade. How can an outside investor who's considering investing in a specific fund, other than having someone like yourself who has experience, give them what the expectation is, how can they read something in the PPM that gives them the loss reserve expectation? Is it going to be there? Is it going to be realistic? How do they measure this?
That's a great question. Fortunately, PPMs don't mention this. Offering memorandums don't mention this. What they do mention is all kinds of risk, but they don't say anything beyond that. Because those are legal disclosure documents. They protect the sponsor and don't give investor, unfortunately, sufficient information. What investors should do is think a little bit about how each investment or each fund fits into those quadrants. Where do they live? Let me go back to the previous slide. Does a given fund live in a quadrant one, the investment philosophy, their strategy, their objectives, or does it live in a quadrant four? So depending on where each vehicle is at, that's basically the initial evaluation. Should not be very difficult to evaluate what is a safe kind of income and growth fund versus an aggressive growth fund focused on speculation. Some things are in between. There's not exact science, but at least folks can start there. The next thing is how much risk-adjusted return to assign. And I want to give very, very high-level guidance here, and this is, again, my personal opinion. It varies by market condition. It varies by types of investments. But generally, investment-grade type of deals have loss reserve of 1 or 2% in that range. So if you're being promoted, say, 12% return, and you're thinking the loss reserve is 1% or 2%, you're expecting to make 10 to 11% risk-adjusted return. If you go into speculative projects, most of the speculative projects we look at, loss reserve should be a lot higher. But there's no right number. Some projects need very, very high loss reserves to the point where investors are not being promised enough return to be upset by the loss reserves. That's so speculative. But generally speaking, I like to use a number around 6%. So if you're being promoted 15% speculative project-like return and you have a 6% loss reserve, you're only getting 9%. Is that worth investing in a project like that when you can get, say, 10, 11 safely? That's a question you got to answer for yourself. But it gives you at least a framework of what this looks like.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, diversified versus focus funds. It's really important, pretty basic concept. So you have a broad investment strategies versus asset-specific or geography-specific or certain mix of debt and equity. So just some simple examples. We have funds in our ecosystem that focus on just North Carolina and South Carolina. That is a focused fund in specific geographic asset, specific geographies. There are funds that focus on only, say, self-storage funds. And all they do is they develop self-storage. They have a focus. And there are diversified funds like Tempo Opportunity Fund that invests in a broad range of strategies, assets, geographies. And our objective is to mix things up, to spread the risk. We're generating income and growth. Some funds are focused strictly on income, and there are some funds that focus strictly on growth. So those are just different concepts. They could be, again, focused on type of an asset, multifamily, office, non-performing notes, self-storage, retail, could be hard money lending, fix and flip funds, gas stations, holdings, and so on and so forth. Well, we talked about the geographies, and some focused on different type of investing. Some funds invest in aggressive mezzanine debt, some invest in preferred equity, some invest in common equity, and some invest in conservative debt. So you should know the difference. Open-ended versus closed-ended funds. So the big difference is open-ended funds are also known as the evergreen funds. And then they raise capital on ongoing basis, typically quarterly. Could be monthly in some cases, could be even annually. But generally it's quarterly. They invest capital coming back from the investments. So they continue, the whole objective is to keep reinvesting money to generate return for investors. And these funds, again, in the private space, they generally mark to market the value of the assets in the fund for the purposes of subscriptions, redemptions. And these type of funds distribute realized gains or realized income on a quarterly basis. And this happens during the subscriptions and redemptions. So it is, it's a quarterly cycle or periodic cycle of investment. People can come in into this fund on a quarterly basis. People can redeem their shares on a quarterly basis, and the income gets distributed on a quarterly basis. Closed-ended funds, a little bit of different beast. Generally speaking, they raise capital during specific periods of time. For example, 12 months period. They purchase assets or make investments. They run through their asset life cycle. So it may be acquisition of assets. Life cycle may vary depending on what kind of asset it is. If it's a, you know, if something needs a construction, renovation, improvement, and sale, then that's the life cycle. If certain funds, they don't do anything like that. They just buy defaulted paper and then they foreclose on that. And that's a perfectly good strategy of an example. It's a single focus, but the life cycle is a foreclosure process. And then they repossess assets and then they sell them. Typically, these type of funds, they distribute income and return capital at various times throughout the life cycle of the fund. They may not have periodic distributions. They may try to distribute income as it becomes available, but they don't have to. Their whole objective is to take assets through the life cycle. And typically, closed-ended funds have a life cycle. So they'll say, listen, we are investing for a 5-year horizon. It might not be exactly 5 years, but that's their approximate timeline for them to cycle and execute their strategy. And as I mentioned, there's a projected exit date. Any questions on these?
I know you're going to talk about realized gains, realized income a little bit later, but I think just for the purpose of this slide, maybe we can just say realized gains, realized income would be actual cash flow, net cash flow, or net interest income based on equity or debt that can be distributed versus unrealized gains, which would be the growth factor, the value add or just appreciation, which is not realized until the asset is sold, correct?
David, thank you very much. That's a brilliant explanation. I appreciate the clarification. Exactly that. So we'll keep going. We'll talk more about that. That's a great point. Versus equity versus debt and equity funds. Just a little bit of a lay of the land. Typically, equity funds sell equity units or shares to fund investors. Equity units may have preferred return. Majority of them don't do. Some funds don't have preferred return, and then they just have a split. So here's an example, could be an equity fund that pays 7% preferred return and splits profits 70-30, 70% to investors and 30% to the managers as a compensation for performance. It's known as the EDC, stands for excess distributable cash split. There are debt funds that don't issue equity, they issue just promissory notes to investors. And the notes typically pay a fixed rate of interest, and sometimes it's a fixed rate and some kind of a variable kicker or variable interest tied to the performance of the fund. And there are mixed funds that do both debt and equity. They both sell notes and they sell equity units. Generally speaking, notes are senior on the capital stack to equity, and therefore they should receive, generally speaking, a little bit lower rate of return because they're taking less risk. And conversely, equity should get higher rate of return because effectively they use notes as a leverage to generate higher return on equity. And remember, the equity works both ways. When things go well, the equity benefits and returns are magnified due to the leverage. When investments don't go well, the leverage can hurt equity investors because note holders got to get paid first.
Yeah, well said. I think people can look at this from the standpoint of just saying if you own a home, but you bought a home and you used the bank to fund that home, who has the best protection in the downside? You as the owner of the house or the bank? Well, the bank does. The first lien, if it's down and you can't afford the house, then you may lose the house. But on the other hand, if the market is going up and up and up, or you're in an area where there's a lot of appreciation, the bank still gets their return, but you as the equity owner actually get the benefit of that upside appreciation. So that's a kind of simple way to look at debt and equity.
Thank you for clarification. That works exactly how it works on a single asset. The same is true on a fund level. Thank you. That was brilliant clarification. So here's an example of some of the equity funds like we talked about could be certain preferred return to investors, some kind of management fee for the management team to keep the lights on, and then a performance split. Here's an example of 60-40 split over 8 pref. Example number two, 7 pref, 1.5 management fee, 730 split above that. Here's another example where there is no pref, but the split is high in favor of investors. Here's an example of an 80-20, just some examples.
So again, a case like that, based on your desired amount of speculation on growth, fund three, for example, that's all growth versus the first example or second example where you get that preferred return and still a split of the growth. So nice mix there. I think I'm glad the way you showed that.
Here's an example of notes. So debt fund that sells notes. Here is an example of a debt table of folks that invest, say, between 100 and 249,000 for 24 months, all they get is 5% rate. But if they park their money for 60 months, they get 7% rate. And similarly, if they invest, say, $1 million or more for 24 months, they get 7.5% rate, and then 8.5% 60 months. So this is self-intuitive. The higher the tier, the better the compensation. And typically, the tiers are linked to the amount of dollars folks invest, and then the longer the term, the better the interest rate for the investors. So let's just compare income versus growth and income funds. So income funds, again, they issue debt instruments. The income funds generate income from debt instruments like loans and cash flow from equity investments. There may be leverage or no leverage, but it's a cash flow and the interest received from the deals. Some of these funds could be leveraged or not. Growth funds typically make equity investments with medium to high value add strategy because their focus is on growth and could be development, redevelopment deal. It's just a typical universe of growth type of deals. And growth and income is a mix of income generating strategies with growth generating as well. So how do funds derive income and growth? Just very simply. So income, and it's also known as realized gains or realized returns. It is income acceptable based on fund accounting. It's not GAAP accounting, just to be clear, because GAAP accounting includes depreciation. It reduces taxable income, but it's actual cash received and it is a distributable cash. So generally points collected, interest collected and fees on loans, cash distributions on equity projects, any other income. And typically this realized gains or realized income is distributable on a quarterly basis. Growth. So growth is also known as unrealized gains or appreciation. Many projects, at least we invest in, have forced appreciation. So the term is used to differentiate versus natural appreciation. So natural appreciation is what happens when tide rises all boats. So all the boats and all the assets are just conditions that they sit in the market. As the market improves, all prices go up. Natural appreciation could be negative, things prices could fall. The forced appreciation is generally value add strategy. It's renovation of apartments, new construction, development, redevelopment. Sometimes the value add strategy is just foreclosing on an asset, or value add strategy could be selling an out parcel in the shopping center. All those are value add strategies and generally increase value of the asset that generates growth. And a total return, generally a combination of income, realized gains, distributable gains, and unrealized gains or growth. And ultimately, in the long run, the unrealized gains or the appreciation converts to realized gains, and it happens upon sale of the assets. And many investors get to realize it when they sell units. So we'll talk a little bit later, when they sell units of the fund. And when the assets sell, they convert unrealized gains to realized gains or distributable income. If they've been held for long enough, they generate long-term capital gains from a tax perspective. So let's just talk a little bit about how open-ended funds work on a quarterly basis. And the reason I wanted to mention this is because people have asked me this question and they don't understand what really happens. So here's an example of a fund like ours, how things run. So quarter ends. So last quarter ended is March 31st, 2019. So what happens is there's a quarterly reporting and distribution timelines. And we set this expectation as much as we can, and we try to communicate this well. A lot of folks don't realize, don't pay attention. So this is why we're mentioning again. Typically, it takes fund administrator approximately 2 months to close the books the previous quarter. Why? Because a lot of assets, they got to get statements, they got to compute all the income. It takes 2 months to do the computation, to compute realized income, and look at the projects that have gone through value add. What happens? Have they increased the value? And what is that worth? So again, it's 2 months for quarter one, two, three. For quarter four, it takes longer. The reason for this is because it's end of the year and there's end of the year activity, including receiving K-1 statements from each of the investments that we make on a fund level. So you just gotta be a little bit patient. If you're looking to invest in a fund like this and you're investing non-IRA money, you have to be filing for extensions because it will not be available and ready by April 15th. So it's very important. Overall, this could generate you good returns, but you have to be patient and realize that's the timeline. So once quarterly results are reported and the statements are distributed, the realized gains are distributed through wires, ACHs, checks. We pay that out. Unrealized gains or appreciation is reported on statements. So if there's growth in the assets of the fund and the shares were trading, say, $1,000 a unit in the past, now it could be $1,020. So there is that appreciation that you see in the form of a share increase. And a total return is a combination of realized gains plus unrealized gains, and both things show up on statements. Typically, statements are distributed by a fund administrator, whoever it is. In our case, we use Redwood Real Estate Administration. New subscriptions and redemptions are processed. All that means that folks who have contributed the money to invest on April 1st, on the first of that next quarter, they subscribe at that point at the price per unit that is at the end of the previous quarter. And the same thing happens in redemptions. If you want to sell your units, you have to wait for fund administrator to compute the price per unit. Then you get your cash when they compute price per unit times number of units you have, and you can sell them. And that's when you get the distribution. So that event happens a day or a couple of days right after the books are closed, and new redemptions can be processed. And new redemptions and new subscriptions could be processed.
Mike, who determines what the value is of the various assets in a fund as far as growth, the unrealized gains, to determine price per unit?
If that's a great question. That is also a difficult question, because we state in our PPM, and that is a key question, it is a stated value methodology. What this means, we make every effort. And as a fund manager, we have no incentive to neither mark up the units nor mark them down. Our only incentive is to perform, because we get paid performance fees for cash distributions, not for marking up the units at all. So we had to disincentivize to be unfair, but we try to be fair to existing investors and to the new investors. What does that mean? It means that if a project is going through significant value add life cycle, we typically develop mathematical models. So what do we think it's going to be worth upon completion of the value add strategy? And the strategy may take many, many months, quarters. So we do the best we can to assess how much improvement has been made to the asset in a given quarter and what unrealized gains or appreciation it justified for that specific investment. So an example, let's just say a certain multifamily had 20 apartments renovated and they start going through the lease process. The fact of renovation took place, a certain amount of capital was invested. The value has been increased by some amount. And we make our best mathematical and educated guesses. And I want to be very clear on this. This is extremely hard to do, because how much, if you have 200 units in a given complex, 20 units got renovated. Is it always a linear? No, it varies. What about external renovation? What about common area? These value-add improvements don't always translate immediately to higher income. You certainly can run appreciation based on cap rates and a value increase based on cash flow increase, but it happens at times through gradual process. Sometimes the complex goes through a lot of external renovations, the roofs get changed, electric, plumbing, and there's no cash flow yet. At the same time, the values increase quite a bit. So we model this to the best of our ability. Say we project an increase of a certain assets based on our investment. is to be, say, $200,000 for the life of a project. And that is based on approximately 4 quarters worth of investment. So we will do the best we can, depending on the progress of that value add strategy. Potentially, it is spread evenly between each quarter if the amount of work is approximately even. At times, it's clumpy. In other words, so the investment could accelerate renovations and they could get ahead of schedule. So they would have to appreciate a certain assets a little bit more if more work has been done. I hope it makes sense.
Yeah, thank you. It has to be a little bit of a guesstimate. As you said, it's going to be not favored towards current investors versus new investors. It's a balancing act that just has to be done, and that's the way you have to go about it.
Yeah, exactly. We try to be conservative to the best of ability. We prefer never to write down an asset if we overwrite it up. So from that perspective, we try to be conservative. We'd love to have more hidden gems in the portfolio than, you know, shiny, bright objects, if that makes sense.
Well, Mike, it's no different than anybody that has to produce a financial statement. We all have had to do that, showing assets and liabilities. And on the asset side, even if you go out and get appraisals, that's still somebody's opinion. That's still an opinion. And you don't know what your actual equity value is until you actually sell an asset into the open market. That's the day you know what it is. And that's when you have a realized gain. So you gave a great explanation. I just want to give people a little bit more consideration on what that looks like. And I think you did a great job. So I think we can go on from there.
Thank you, David. So how do investors receive unrealized gains? This question came up and it was a brilliant question. I love the question because it's the right question. We would have on a quarterly report statement say return was 10% and they only got distributed 7%. What happened to the other 3% or the other 4%, whatever it was? Well, the answer to the question is it's an increase in the value of the shares. So most simply speaking, the unrealized gains will be shown. The beginning of the quarter, the price could be, say, $1,000 per unit, and then the quarter becomes $1,040 a unit. So it's 4% unrealized gains and during that period of time, and it translates in the higher value of the units of shares. So how do you cash it out? Well, you can cash it by redeeming units. You can sell stock quarterly basis or whatever the subscription period and redemption period is, and you would receive that in cash. So this is the sale of appreciated stock. It's simple as that. The second way this happens is when unrealized gains turn into realized gains when an asset is sold. So for example, we could make a $300,000 investment. We have $300,000 unrealized gains on an investment of $500,000 through value add project. So that investment is trading on the books at the value of $800,000. And the asset sells, it will receive cash of $800,000. So what the fund does, it reduces the unrealized gains to $300,000 on paper, and it tracks $300,000 of realized gains that quarter, and that $300,000 becomes distributable as cash. So that's what happens during a sale of an asset. So unrealized gains in the books of the fund will be reduced by the amount of realized gains created in that quarter. At a point of a sale. I hope it makes sense.
So there's basically two ways to receive unrealized gains. You can redeem shares or the actual assets within the fund are sold, correct?
Exactly.
That. Okay, very good.
So some funds are long-term and some funds are short-term. That's their strategy. It's really important to know what you're investing into. So let me give you some examples. Some long-term funds could be focused on long-term risk-adjusted return over 3 to 5 year life cycle, and that's the objective. And some are focused on a value-add strategy, improving the future value. And some are focused on asset appreciation or other immediate income. These are long-term strategies. All of them they're driven by the fund strategy, and the fund managers execute these type of strategies. The short-term investing strategy is generally focused on short-term gains, cash flow, distributions, maximizing current yield. It could be fix and flip type of activity, but it's a short-term exit strategy, and they are very different in their purpose and in execution. But I wanted to state this so folks know what they're investing into. Is a given investment long-term or short-term? And is it focused on cash flow or is it focused on growth? So here's an example of value-add investing, some pros and cons. So value-add investing is typically focused on value-add-driven appreciation, also known as the forced appreciation. They generally provide tax benefits. They could have paper losses, and they could also take advantage of the depreciation. At times, accelerated depreciation, and they could have cost segregation-driven depreciation. So there's certainly good pros. And the ultimate long-term goal is to grow the cash flow in the future at the end of the value-add life cycle. If you can't grow the cash flow in the future, the project is purely speculative. But most projects, even speculative, they expect the cash flow to grow at the end of the project, even if they would like to sell the units rather than lease them up. Some of the cons of the value-add investing: you have no or low cash flow. It's certainly a drawback. And what you may see is a concept called yield drag. It's sort of an opposite of tax benefit, because tax benefit provides paper losses and reduces realized gains or realized income, reducing tax liabilities. The converse is true. The yield drag is just the value increases, but there's no cash flow, and then there are paper losses that pass through to investors through this yield drag concept. And there's some risk associated with the ability to execute value-add strategy. So it's one of the cons. If the value-add strategy takes too long or fails, the project could have risks. So just wanted to show the difference.
Yeah, like development or redevelopment projects that could get into all kinds of issues, zoning issues and labor issues, and certainly exit financing, long-term financing issues. It all depends. So I think you made some great points there.
Yeah, exactly. Value-add strategy concept by itself is a pretty powerful concept. And most of the sizable returns are realized when the value-add strategy takes place and completes. But it has risks, and it's important to know the difference. Now let's look at the world of the income and growth investing. So fund manager's dilemma. Again, this is a mixed fund like ours. And the funds that have a single strategy may not have the same dilemma. But for us, we like to focus on both. So when we focus on growth, the value-add project, we have to deal with the yield drag. And the yield drag is exactly what happens when we invest for long term. It impacts our ability to distribute cash in the short run. And on the other side, we want to invest to generate income, such as performing notes or cash flow focused deals. So given our mandate and a diversified strategy, I deal with it every day as a fund manager. Every investment we look at, we think about this: what is it going to do to the portfolio? Is it going to help long-term, or is it going to help the short-term objectives? So please note, returns are clumpy in a fund like ours. It's not always linear. What does that mean? It means that there are projects that go through value-add life cycle, and they could have significant bumps up when these value-add execution takes place. And returns could be steady most quarters, and then you can have a significant bump up. Also, what could happen is distributions could vary quite a bit depending on sale event. So if one of the assets in the portfolio sells, it creates a lot of realized gains, might convert some unrealized gains to realized gains, and that creates significant distributions. So it's always a mix between distributable income and a total income, which is a combination of both distributable income or realized gains plus the unrealized gains. So quarterly yield may fluctuate a little bit depending on the results. Please know that the quarter four will have a little bit more yield drag because of the paper losses driven by the K1 distributions. Distributions may or may not be at level of pref. Pref is just it's a concept in addition to realized income. It gives preferential distribution to investors before managers get any performance pay. But there might be quarters where we can meet the pref, and there may be quarters where we exceed the pref. We have cumulative pref, which is the way it's supposed to be, but some funds don't even have that. And as the sale events could drive distribution yield a lot. So you could have normal distributions of 7%, and you may have one quarter that has distributable yield at 18% because of that single event. My two cents is focus on the long-term return rather than quarterly performance. Especially private funds, they're not reporting on a quarterly basis. They're not worried about their quarterly short-term focus. It's all about the long-term risk-adjusted return. That's the key point here. Any thoughts, David, on this?
No, I think you're good.
Here's a fund summary of the Temp Opportunity Fund recent quarter. So I'm showing green. Green is cash. Blue is total return. And as you can see, there could be a little bit of fluctuation up and down. Last quarter, because it was Q4, realized gains were a little bit low. But total return is still in line. We're a little below projections running now. But if you look at the average return since inception, we are within the projected range. And again, on a long-term basis, we believe we have a good number of hidden gems. Over time, they'll come through, and we'll be able to meet or exceed our target return. But again, no guarantees. There's certainly risks involved. Market conditions could change, and various other things could happen. We continue to grow the fund at a pretty, you know, pretty decent pace, $2 to $2.5 million a quarter on a capital base. It's the amount of money we're easily able to deploy, and we try to be very opportunistic, picking and choosing the right battles. And the fund distributes realized gains quarterly. So how to read fund reported results? You should look at a couple of variables. Number one, you should look at the last quarter and the trailing 12 months. It shows you what has happened recently. It should not be the only decision point, but it helps you see the current picture. So you see current distributions in the last 12 months. Should also look at the return since inception because it gives you a little bit more long-term perspective. Please note that the market conditions could change. Sometimes they get better, sometimes they get worse. And look at the fund inception date and a fund strategy. So young funds like ours that have been around, our fund's been around for a little over 2 years. We do make investments for long-term and they haven't come through the entire life cycle. So the consequence is that you may not see full potential in a fund like ours until these investments cycle through the entire life cycle. And then distributions increase because these assets are now realizing a higher gain or higher cash flow. And absolutely focus on the fund strategy. If it's a growth-focused strategy, the cash flow may be impacted by the yield drag from long-term investments. Look at the fund size. So it's important because young and small funds can generate high or low results. There could be a lot of variance. As the funds get bigger, the impact of fresh capital and impact of each individual project becomes less and less given the fund size and fund diversification. So a little bit older funds, at this point, we are over 2 years old. We have a degree of stability and predictability. Some really young funds don't have that, and some really old funds may not have the same because of the yield drag from sort of old investments have gone through their life cycle.
Yeah, that's a great point that I think a lot of people don't consider when they're potentially investing in a fund. What's the age of that fund? Really good, Mike.
Thank you, David. It's an important point because there's a lot of difference. And a lot of great managers set wonderful portfolios that take time to perform. So if you can see between the lines, at times, pure distributions don't mean anything. And the reverse could be true. A really old fund could still be doing very well because they've been consistently executing a phenomenal exit strategy when the older assets. So it really varies kind of fund by fund. A couple of words about Temp Opportunity Fund. So we're focused on strong cash flow, value-add driven appreciation. We mix up hard money loans and equity deals with predictable cash flow and forced appreciation. Everything for us is network driven. Your net worth is your network, or your network is your net worth. We go to a lot of masterminds. We have deal flow coming only from known relationships or their strong referrals. We don't take cold business from the street. We try to diversify relentlessly among various dimensions. We have investor-focused split, as you can see, and no manager-only fees, and we target better risk-adjusted return, current projected 10 to 13%.
Mike, as you said, you're a part of various masterminds. You travel a lot to go to different conferences, symposiums. You are well networked, and that's what gives you the opportunity that you have through Temple Opportunity Fund to make sound, prudent investments in the cash flow and the value add that you're able to do. That's what gives you strength. It's who you know and the track record of the people that you invest through. People don't always appreciate that when they are investing in a fund, but they got to know, you know, who's that manager, what's their experience level, what's their connections. That's what makes it work, in my opinion.
Thank you, David. And I have to say that I greatly appreciate you run a phenomenal mastermind, Freedom Founders. And that group helps so many people in so many ways to better understand what they have, what investments they have, what is their goals, where they're going. And by the time they go through your process, your life cycle of help, they come out much more educated folks and they make better investment decisions. And we love to work with folks who are well-educated and they're well-prepared to make the right decisions so that they can understand what they're investing into. So keep rolling. So what does the fund invest into? So here are a few examples. We invest in loans secured by mortgages or deed of trust. We also invest in various equity deals, self-storage facilities, multifamily, retail shopping centers. We love this space. There's a lot of opportunity. A lot of shopping centers selling at massive discounts. REITs are selling, and the opportunities are phenomenal because there's a fear of Amazon. So it goes back to the concept, can you buy something at a steep, steep discount with strong downside protection? And we find some interesting opportunities in that space. There are certainly risks, but just giving you that as a contrarian play, and we love some contrarian great buys. Similarly, office space, some industrial, self-storage, as I mentioned, single-family portfolios. We invest in other funds and in various other real estate transactions. We do only real estate. How do folks invest in a fund? Again, this is not solicitation at all. Please go to this website, create an account, download private placement memorandum, then you can consider the investment. Only through the private placement memorandum, the offering could be made. And this is a little bit of information. I am available at your service. I appreciate your time and your consideration, your thoughts. David, any other comments, anything else?
No, just a well-outlined presentation, Mike. I appreciate what you do as far as educating our investors out in the space. You do a great job, and I can very much vouch and endorse who you are and what you do. So thanks for your contribution today.
David, thank you very much. I appreciate you joining me on this call. I did put together a good amount of content, but your insight and your clarity is just outstanding. So I'm grateful for your time and your thoughts and your leadership. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike Zlotnick. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.